Well, if you were not here with us last week, this is actually part two of a two-part message. And I will do a little bit of a review to catch you up to speed if you happen to miss our last study. But I'm going to go ahead and read the entire passage, both of what we covered last week as well as what we're going to be covering tonight. And it is found here in Mark chapter 5, and we're going to begin reading with verse 21 and read on down to the very end of the chapter. So why don't you follow along with me as I read. Verse 21. Now when Jesus had crossed over by boat to the other side, a great multitude gathered to him, and he was by the sea. And behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name. And when he saw him, he fell at his feet and begged him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter lies at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her that she may be healed, and she will live." So Jesus went with him, and a great multitude followed him and thronged him. Verse 25, now a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years and had suffered many things from many physicians. She had spent all that she had and was no better, but rather grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. For she said, "If only I may touch his clothes, I shall be made well." Immediately the fountain of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of the affliction. And Jesus, immediately knowing in himself that power had gone out of him, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" But his disciples said to him, "You see the multitude thronging you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see her who had done this thing. But the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. Be healed of your affliction." While he was still speaking, some came from the ruler of the synagogue's house who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" As soon as Jesus heard the words that were spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not be afraid, only believe." And he permitted no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. Then he came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue and saw a tumult of those who wept and wailed loudly. And when he came in, he said to them, "Why make this commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping." And they ridiculed him. But when he had put them all outside, he took the father and the mother of the child and those who were with him and entered where the child was lying. Then he took the child by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kumi," which is translated, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." Immediately the girl arose and walked, for she was 12 years of age. And they were overcome with great amazement. But he commanded them strictly that no one should know it, and said that something should be given to her to eat. I have a friend who came to me a few months ago and said, "You know what, if we had met several years ago, we would have never been friends." And I thought about it, and I had to agree with him on several points. For one, he's a Yankees fan, and that in and of itself probably would have prevented us from being good friends. But in addition to that, there's a big difference in age. He's a lot younger than I am, and so there's a generational difference, which probably would have prevented a good friendship. We also have very different backgrounds. He grew up in a very different environment than I did. And the circles that we ran in several years ago would have been drastically different as well. And so all of these differences probably would have prevented us at that time from becoming good friends. But I'll tell you what, we're good friends today. And we're good friends for one reason, because Jesus has basically nullified all of those differences between us. We have found a common faith in the Lord, and that one common faith has made all of the difference. And so it is in the lives of many people who on one level probably would never have their paths crossed, but when their lives intersect Jesus, suddenly those who would not have been friends suddenly find a commonality in Jesus. And that's what we find in this story. So we just read about the lives of two individuals, both going through a tremendous crisis, who on any other day or through any other circumstances probably would never have had a conversation with each other. And yet on this one day, because of their common situations, they're in desperate need of the touch of Jesus. I mean, their similarities were almost non-existent other than their common need. They came from drastically different economic backgrounds. She was a woman who was impoverished because of her situation. He was a man who was fairly prominent within the community, and because of that, he was flourishing. She would have been someone who in the society was rejected by most because of this flow of blood, as we had talked about last week. This flow of blood made her unclean. Nobody in the Jewish culture would have wanted to be made unclean by associating with her, so she probably had few, if any, friends at all. On top of that, she would have not been able to enter into the synagogue to worship because anyone with the ailment that she had was not permitted to do so. He, on the other hand, was in charge of the synagogue there in Capernaum, and so he was in a much, you know, different situation. And yet, their lives were going to converge because she is going through a crisis, albeit her crisis has been going on for 12 years. She has had this illness for 12 years, 12 years of misery. He, on the other hand, his affliction is going to come on him suddenly as his daughter is ill to the point where she may die. And because of this common need for help, both of their lives are going to converge on Jesus at this particular time. It does tell us something, I believe, that is really important for us to understand, and that is this, is that the ground is level at the foot of the cross. It does not matter how prominent you are in life or how destitute you are. It doesn't matter how popular you are or how much of an outcast you feel. It does not matter your situation in life. At the foot of the cross of Jesus, we are all equal. We are all in the same desperate need for His forgiveness, for the life that only He could give us. And that's what we find in the story of these two individuals. Now, last week, we looked at the woman of the story. We took a look at her circumstance and saw how desperate she was. And her desperation was not just because she had this illness for 12 years, but because the illness had made her ostracized from society. As I said already, because of that illness, she herself was ceremonially unclean, which meant that anybody that she touched would then become unclean themselves. Well, nobody in that culture would want to be deemed unclean, and so they would have avoided her. So not only does she have this physical ailment, she would have had this social ostracization. Am I making up a word? She would have been cut off. She would have been cut off from the rest of society because of her ailment as well. She also had impoverished herself financially because, as the passage says, she had spent all of her money trying to get well through the physicians. And yet, instead of getting any better, it says that she rather grew worse. So out of desperation, she had come to Jesus, hearing that He might be able to make a difference in her life. Maybe too afraid to approach Him and make herself known, she thought, if I can just come up behind Him without Him or anybody else noticing me, if I could just touch His garment, maybe I will be made well. And as we have just read the story, we know that is exactly what happened. And Jesus not only healed this woman, but He, by calling her out, also acknowledged that He was accepting her as His own daughter. Because at the end of the passage, He said, "Daughter, your faith has made you well." Verse 34, "Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." But now we come to the story of the other individual that is in this story, a man by the name of Jairus. And like I said, his circumstances were very different. First of all, his situation in life was a far cry from this woman's situation. He was a ruler of the synagogue in Capernaum. Now, that does not mean that he was a priest. The ruler of the synagogue was not functioning as a priest, a go-between between God and the people, as much as he basically was an administrator of the goings-on that were there at the synagogue there in Capernaum. He oversaw the operations that that were going on there. He was responsible for everything that was taking place. And because of that, he was in a position of real respect. He would have been known in society. As he walked down the street, people would want to greet him because they had great admiration for who he was. He was a person of respect, much different than this woman had been facing. But now he has found himself in a position of absolute desperation, because his daughter, who was 12 years old at the time, has now gotten gravely ill. Now, I want you to think that while this woman was going through 12 years of misery, this man was going through 12 years of amazement. As he is raising his daughter, and as any of you who are parents know, when your child is born into the world, and as you begin to nurture them and raise them, and watch them take their first steps, and hear them say their first words, and take them to their first day of kindergarten, and all the other special occasions that go in with raising a child, your love for that child just grows. So as much as you think when that child is born, you could not possibly love another human being more than you do, you find that over the course of time, that love for your children just deepens and grows and matures. And so you got to imagine that for 12 years, this man had been raising his daughter. And by the way, in Luke's account of this story, Luke mentions that this was his only daughter, possibly his only child, which all the more would have endeared this girl, his daughter, to himself. So while the woman was going through 12 years of misery, this man was going through 12 years of enjoyment. But now that enjoyment has suddenly hit a huge crisis because his daughter has gotten gravely ill. And if you'll notice that in the end of verse 23, when he begins to speak to Jesus, he says, "My little daughter lies at the point of death." That terminology there in the Greek language literally meant that she had reached the final stage. I don't know if that is something that he realized or whether a physician that was attending to her said, "This is the time to begin to say your goodbyes because she will not be around very long." You can imagine the desperation that this father was feeling. I've had the unfortunate opportunity to preside over several funerals of children. I don't know that I personally have been able to witness on the face of a human being greater agony than to watch your child die. These parents are going through something that, thank God, I've never experienced. But it is heart-wrenching, because it seems like it is so backwards. We believe that our children are going to outlive us. We think that that is the right structure, the way things are supposed to operate in life. We know that none of us are going to live forever, at least on this planet. But we believe, because we're significantly older than our kids, that it will be our turn first, and they will bury us. But when a parent has to bury a child, it is so unnerving, because you see on their faces the desperation and the emptiness of losing their child. And here is a man who is on the brink of experiencing that. He knows that his daughter is at the point of death. He does not know how much time he has. All he knows is that he no longer has control of the situation. Now, you need to understand, he was a man of prominence, which probably meant that he also was a man of means, which meant that he had access to all of the best medicine that the world had to offer at that time. No doubt he had exhausted his resources trying to find a solution to his daughter's situation, but his prominence now didn't matter. His wealth was of no value. And when you get to that desperate of a situation, suddenly the things that you used to think were so important now have no importance for your life whatsoever. There's only one thing that matters. And in his life, it was that his daughter would live. Many of you know the name Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was the co-founder of the Apple Corporation. And he, over a period of building up this company, built it into really the most, I believe it is maybe still today, the most profitable corporation business in the entire world. He himself had a net worth of about $10 billion. But in 2003, he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and went through a series of treatments to try and treat his situation. But in 2011, he ended up dying from that disease. His prominence, his company, his billions could not keep him alive. And I read a quote from him when he said this. He said, "Being the richest man in the cemetery doesn't matter to me." There's an author by the name of Temple Thurston who lived about 100 years ago. He was both an author and a poet. He'd written several different things. But in one of his books in particular, he tells his view of life, at least in a particular sense, when he said, you know what, when your life is prosperous, when your life is good, it seems like you are the ringmaster of your own circus. You're there and you are wearing the long coat and the top hat, and you have the whip in your hand, and everything is orchestrated according to how you have structured it. Everything is going as you plan until the lion gets out of the cage. And then suddenly, he said, life stands up and looks you in the face. And that's what is taking place with Jairus right here. A man who, up to this point, probably had his act together and things were going pretty well for him. Suddenly, life has just gotten up and stared him in the face as his daughter is lying on her deathbed. I want you to see what he has to say to Jesus. Verse 22 again. "And behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name, and when he saw him, he fell at his feet and begged him earnestly, saying, 'My little daughter lies at the point of death. Come and lay your hand on her that she may be healed, and she will live.' So Jesus went with him, and a great multitude followed him and thronged him." I first want us to consider the fact that this man came to Jesus even in the first place. Understand, he is the ruler of the synagogue. That was an established religious position. Now, Jesus had been to Capernaum before. In fact, that was one of the hubs of his ministry. And if you want to look back at Luke chapter 4, you'll find, I think it's somewhere around verse 30 to verse 40 or so, it shares a little bit about what Jesus had actually done during his ministry in Capernaum. And in that particular passage, he encounters a man who was demon-possessed. And he casts out this demon from this man and restores him to perfect health. It also says that he was teaching in the synagogue, which very well might have been Jairus' synagogue. So Jairus might have been there. But in the passage, it in particular says that Jesus taught like others did not teach, because he taught with power and with authority. So if this was some of the exposure that Jairus had to Jesus prior to his daughter getting sick, he knows that Jesus was a powerful teacher and was able to do some pretty wondrous works. And a lot of people, probably in Jairus' community, were enthralled with Jesus and were following after him. In fact, many that might have attended his synagogue were part of this crowd that were now following after Jesus. But on the other hand, because of his position, many of those that were in authority over him in the religious culture of the day were the enemies of Jesus. They were the ones that were talking evil of him, rejecting his teaching, trying to find fault in him. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes. All of these would have been men in the community that were above Jairus and probably would have talked much against Jesus, maybe even in the presence of Jairus. So Jairus was probably kind of in the middle here. He's got those that were part of the synagogue that he attended that thought so highly of Jesus. He's got those that are over him who only had negative things to say about Jesus. So he might have found himself kind of in the middle, not really knowing what to make of this itinerant preacher. But now that his daughter is in her situation and his life personally is in crisis, he's got a choice to make. Do I stand with those who are above me who say that this man is a blasphemer and he's not from God? Or do I consider the things that he did in my own synagogue and maybe listen to the people that are following him? You know, I think a lot of people in our society are in that same situation. They've got some people in their life who speak highly of Jesus. They're the Christians, the ones who are always encouraging certain individuals that you need to give your life over to Christ. He wants to forgive you. He wants to give you eternal life. He wants to bless you. And yet, in their other ear, they have other people, maybe other family members, co-workers, or what have you, that are saying, that stuff's ridiculous. You don't want to believe that stuff. You know, don't go crazy and become one of those freaks. But I tell you what, when a person's life comes into crisis and they have exhausted all of their other resources, sometimes Jesus is their last resort. What's a blessing is Jesus isn't offended by that. Jesus doesn't get offended when you come to him as your last resort. When you get to the end of your rope and you turn to the Lord, you'll find that he is just as gracious with you as he is with the person that turned to him the first time around. I don't know if Jairus was basically coming to Jesus as an absolute last resort, but it would sure appear so. Here is a man who knows that his daughter is on her deathbed, and he knows that Jesus is in town. And maybe in spite of what those above him were saying about Jesus, he was going to go to Jesus because he was desperate. And if you'll notice, it says that he fell at the feet of Jesus. He lost his composure. He didn't come to him as if he was an equal. He came to him as a man who was broken, who knew that he was dealing with a circumstance that was beyond his control. And he fell at the feet of the one that he thought just might be able to make a difference. And we do get a glimmer of his faith, because he says in verse 23, "My little daughter lies at the point of death. Come and lay your hand on her that she may be healed, and she will live." So to some point, he did have faith that Jesus could do something for him. And Jesus immediately gets up to follow him. And I got to think that encouraged Jairus so much. He is going to come. He's going to come to my house. Maybe now something good is going to happen for my daughter. But then we get to the interruption. I want you to notice first in verse 24. "So Jesus went with him, and a great multitude followed him and thronged him." That word "thronged" there actually meant to be pressed in on every side. Essentially, it's describing a scene where, as Jesus is beginning to go with Jairus to get to Jairus' house, there were so many people that were wanting to be near Jesus, that they were in front of him, they were behind him, they were on either side. And as you know, when you are in a crowd that is that condensed, it is very hard to make much progress. You are not going to go very fast. And I got to imagine that Jairus is already feeling, okay, I've got Jesus, he's coming to my house, but we got to make this faster. I mean, we cannot be blocked in with all of these people. So maybe he was getting a bit agitated. But it would only get worse, because the next verse, it says this, "Now a certain woman had a flow of blood for 12 years. And we're introduced to the woman who was in need of her healing. And suddenly, here is this woman who is coming up behind Jesus to reach out to touch the hem of his garment. And suddenly, Jesus stops. And we are interrupted by this whole instance of Jesus ministering to this woman when a few minutes ago he was set to go to Jairus' house to minister to his daughter. And I've got to think that this would have driven Jairus crazy. He knows that his daughter only has a matter of time before her life is going to be over. And when you're in a situation like that, you are desperate for something to happen and you want it to happen quick. Have you ever been in a situation like that? Where you need God to do something in your life and you need it to happen like right now. This is not a prayer that you're praying that you can wait 6 months or a year for an answer. You might not even be able to wait a week or maybe even a day. It's something that you need God's immediate attention right now. And the Lord doesn't seem like he's in a hurry. I've got to tell you that I have a real problem with being impatient. I should hear a big amen from this section over here right now. I will say it again. I am a very impatient man. That's my wife, by the way. She knows me very well, and it's the truth. It is an issue for me. I like things to progress, and I like them to happen in a timely fashion. And I get a little bent out of sorts when they don't happen as I want them to happen. When I go to the grocery store, I get my stuff, I go to the front, and I immediately make an assessment, which of these lines is going to be the quickest? It's not always the shortest line. I also have to gauge the clerks that are there, which one is moving fastest, and which one does not seem like they are in a hurry at all. And I make my determination to get into a line. But it's even worse than that. What I do is I look at the other lines to see who is the last person in each of those lines so I know who I would have been behind. And then I wait and see as I'm getting closer, are they getting served before I get served or not? Because that's going to gauge how upset I get before I leave that store. It really is a disease, I think, that I have. And if the person in front of me, I might get it in a short line, and I got somebody in front of me, and, you know, their stuff is being scanned, and then I see that person pull out a checkbook, I think, oh, that just added 2 more minutes to my wait. I get the same way at the gas station. You know, you pull into the gas station and you try and figure out, okay, which, you know, lane am I going to go in, which is going to take me the least amount of time. And if somebody gets out of their car, starts filling up their tank, but then they go into the mini mart and come out 7 minutes later with a bag of Doritos, I'm upset because you should have just gotten your gas. Those Doritos are a lot cheaper if you just go across the street to the grocery store. And that's just how I operate. And it is a sin, and I need God's help with that. But those are relatively minor things, and they should not be an issue. But there are times that things seem to be a little bit more severe for us, when we do need something to happen for us in a very timely manner, and we pray for God's help, and we don't sense that he is responding as quickly as we think that he should. And I got to imagine that Jairus is in this situation. When he asked Jesus and Jesus began to follow him, he was encouraged. When the crowd began to press in on Jesus to slow him down, he got discouraged. When the woman needs help from Jesus, and Jesus stops, now he's a little bent out of shape, if he was anything like me. Why isn't Jesus handling my need before stopping for her need. I got to him first. And my situation is more desperate than hers. She's got an illness that she's had for a long time. She'll have it tomorrow, and he can heal her then. But my daughter is at the point of death. I need him now. But I want you to understand that Jesus is never operating according to your timetable. He's on his own timetable. And I will tell you also that though Jesus is never in a hurry, he is never late. And whatever your need is or my need is or the desperation that we feel at any given point in time and we think that right now God has to answer and it cannot be delayed, I will guarantee you there will be situations that there will be a delay. And you think that the delay is God maybe not caring, or you might interpret that delay means that God does not think that this is important, or maybe that he is not listening to you. But that could not be further from the truth. I want to tell you a few reasons why the Lord may delay. In John's Gospel, chapter 11, we read the familiar story of Lazarus, who was lying at the point of death. He had two sisters, Mary and Martha, and they loved their brother, and so they wanted him to be made well. Hearing that Jesus was not in town, but near enough to get a message to him, sent people to Jesus to say, "The one that you love, Lazarus, he is very sick. Please come and touch him." It's interesting that Jesus' response, I think it's chapter 11, verse 4, he says, "This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God." One of the reasons that the Lord allows afflictions in our life, and on top of that, sometimes even compounds that with a delayed response, is for his glory. Now, I can't necessarily explain how he will glorify himself in your situation. But what I know is this, is that Jesus, in the situation of Lazarus, was going to work not according to Mary's timeline or Martha's, but according to his own timeline, because his timeline would bring the most glory to God. Secondly, it goes on in the passage to say this: Jesus loved Lazarus and Mary and Martha. And because of that, he stayed where he was for two more days. Now we shake our head at that and we think, well, that doesn't make any sense. It should read, "Now Jesus loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus, and because of that, he went immediately to go and touch and heal Lazarus." But that's not what it says. He loved them, and so he stayed where he was for two more days. Now, how can that be a sign of love? Again, it goes back to the glory of God. Jesus had a greater work in mind than just a healing. He had a resurrection in mind. And as we know, the story unfolds, Jesus, by the time he gets there, 4 days later, Lazarus is in the grave. And Martha greets him, "Jesus, if only you had been here, my brother would have been made well." Her "if only" basically was a statement saying, "I knew that you could have done something while he was sick, but now it's too late. He's dead." But Jesus doesn't operate within our thinking. He operates in a much grander scheme. He is seeking to glorify God. He is seeking to love us. Now, some of us might think, you know, "Lord, you don't need to love me that much to delay as often as you do." But the reality is this, is that there are times that God is not going to answer in your timeline. He's not going to seem in your situation to be in a hurry, though you think that that would be the right the right way to handle it. But his delay may be to love you to a greater extent, to glorify himself to a greater extent, or both. So the delay happens. Jairus is there, twiddling his thumbs, waiting for this whole situation to be done with the woman so that they could begin to make progress. But even before Jesus and the woman had finished their conversation, notice what it says in verse 35. While he was still speaking, the he being Jesus, some came from the ruler of the synagogue's house who said, "Your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further?" And I got to imagine that Jairus' heart just sunk right there. It's too late. My daughter is gone. At least if Jairus didn't think that way, surely the messengers thought that way, because they finished, "Why trouble the teacher any further?" In other words, don't bother Jesus anymore. There's nothing else he can do. They didn't believe anything could happen at that point. She's gone. And see, sometimes in our situations, we get to that point where there's no more that can be done. God's opportunity to move has expired. He didn't move. He didn't answer my prayer. And now it's too late. And because of that, maybe we stop praying. Or maybe we get very disappointed in the Lord. Sometimes God has something else that he wants to do. Something greater, something that is beyond our understanding. I can't begin to tell you what that is. And maybe sometimes for us, this side of heaven, we will never know. We may be in the kingdom before he explains to us why he waited longer than we thought he should have. And he'll have to unfold to us how he glorified himself or how he loved us through that situation. But I will tell you this, that Jesus is never in a hurry, but he is also never late to what it is that he wants to accomplish in your life and how he wants to glorify himself. As far as the messengers were concerned, now it was too late. It might be that Jairus was kind of feeling the same way, but there is no too late to the Lord. I want you to notice what it says in the next verse, verse 36, how Jesus responds. As soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he said to the ruler of the synagogue, "Do not be afraid, only believe." I want you to know that Luke, who also records the same story, gave an expanded version of what Jesus' response was. Here in Mark, it says that Jesus responded, "Do not be afraid, only believe." But Luke says that what Jesus said in totality, or the full statement, was, "Do not be afraid, only believe, and she may be made well." Now, I want to make a distinction here, not just in that Luke quoted Jesus in totality, but also what Jesus said. Do not be afraid, only believe, and she may be made well. He did not say, only believe, then she may be made well. He said, and she may be made well. Now, that might sound like a very subtle difference, but I think it's profound. Had Jesus said, only believe, then she may be made well, it would hang her healing completely on Jairus' belief in her healing. But the way that Jesus actually phrased it, only believe, what was he saying to believe in? Only believe, and she may be made well. We need to separate those two things, because the belief, I believe, that Jesus was calling her to was belief in himself. Only believe in me, and she may be made well. Not that she may be made well, not then she may be made well, but and she may be made well. And here's why I think that that's such an important distinction. Because the Lord does not always heal. There are times that God heals. There are times that he does not heal. In John chapter 5, we get the story of Jesus going to the Pool of Bethesda, a place where many of the sick would gather because they believed that the stirring of the water would happen on occasion when an angel would come down, and the first person that would get into the water would receive a healing from God. And so many of those that had diseases would gather there at the Pool of Bethesda. Well, Jesus came by one particular day, and there was a man who was lame for 38 years lying at the pool, and the Lord healed him. And that man was restored to complete health. But not everybody that was at the pool that day received a healing. Just one man. There are times that God does heal. There are times that God does not heal our physical infirmities. And if our faith, if our belief is in the healing, and we are not healed, it could be crushing to our faith. We can begin to think that God is not faithful to us. We can believe that maybe God cannot do it. But if our faith is in the Lord Himself, I guarantee you will never be disappointed. Maybe it's not a physical ailment. Maybe it's a situation that you just need God's deliverance from. But again, there are times that God delivers and there's other times that God does not deliver. In Acts chapter 12, we get the story of Peter, who is incarcerated because of his proclamation of the gospel. And it's very possible that his incarceration was going to result in an execution. But in the middle of the night, the passage says that an angel showed up, opened the gates of that prison, led Peter out past the guards, and set Peter free. And we can rejoice in that and think, wow, God did a great thing for Peter. But you know, in the same chapter, we also read of one of the other disciples who was beheaded, James, who was the first of the 12 disciples to be martyred for his faith, is also recorded in Acts chapter 12. So one, his situation resulted in an execution. The other was delivered by an angel from that prison cell. Sometimes God delivers, sometimes God does not. So if our faith is in a certain expectation of what we want God to do, and God doesn't do it as we desire Him to do it, we're crushed. We're disappointed. But if your faith is in the Lord Himself, no matter what the outcome, no matter what the outcome, you can stand because you know that your God is faithful. You might be healed, you might not be healed, but your God stands true. You might be delivered, you might not be delivered. But if your faith is in God, you find out that God, still in spite of the affliction, will meet every need. And we see this as Paul says in 2 Corinthians, that he cried out to the Lord because of this thorn in his side over and over again. He prayed that the Lord would deliver him from this thorn in his flesh. And eventually the Lord not only did not heal him or deliver him from whatever that affliction was, but responded to him saying, Paul, I'm not going to heal you because my strength is going to be made perfect in your weakness. I am going to glorify myself through your affliction. And that satisfied Paul. Paul then realized, okay, God, you are bigger than my problem. And as long as my faith is in you and not in my deliverance, I'm going to be okay. And I want to guarantee every one of you in here, I don't know what your battle is today, if you have a battle. It might be like the woman you've been battling for 12 years. It might be something that suddenly come upon you, just like Jairus's daughter having this illness come upon her. But I tell you what, if your faith is in a certain outcome, it is possible you're going to be disappointed. God might not work the way you want Him to work. But if your faith is in the Lord Himself, I guarantee you, He will never let you down. He will never leave you. He will never forsake you. He is a faithful God. And through it, He will glorify himself through it. He is going to love you because that's what he does. Our faith does not need to be in a certain result. Our faith needs to be in a certain God. It should not be in a healing. It should be in the healer. It should not be in a particular deliverance. It should be in the deliverer. And if that's where your faith is, I guarantee you, you will not be let down. Well, in this situation, Jesus assures him, believe. Believe in me, and she may be made well. And that's what we're going to find out happen here. Verse 37. And he permitted no one to follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And then he came to the ruler of the synagogue and saw a tumult, and those who wept and wailed loudly. And when he came in, he said to them, why do you make this commotion and weep? And the child is not dead, but sleeping. And they ridiculed him. And by the way, those that were there weeping and wailing loudly, it was a common practice in that day that when a family member had passed away, you would actually hire what they called professional mourners who would come and express tremendous remorse. It might have been comparable to we buy flowers to give to in memory of the person who has passed away, or to the family of that is grieving the one who has passed away. They would hire mourners who would grieve the death of the person who had died. So these that are grieving loudly, Jesus basically, comes in and says, hey, you know what? She's not dead. She's sleeping. Which does not mean that she wasn't literally dead. But in biblical terms, sleep was a symbol of death. And he said the word sleeping because he knew that he was going to wake her up. Verse 40. And they ridiculed him, but when he had put them all outside, he took the father and the mother of the child and those who were with him and entered where the child was lying. Then he took the child by the hand and said to her, Talitha kumi, which is translated, little girl, I say to you, arise. Immediately the girl arose and walked, for she was 12 years of age. And they were overcome with great amazement. But he commanded them strictly that no one should know it, so that and said that something should be given to her to eat. So Jairus got his healing. It didn't happen like he thought it would happen. His daughter actually had died, but Jesus would raise her up. So the Lord did glorify himself. He did a greater work for Jairus than Jairus had originally intended. And he did love Jairus by raising up his daughter to life. Jesus might have been Jairus' last resort. He might have exhausted every other avenue before he came to Jesus, but he came to Jesus. And so Jesus honored that by raising her up. You know, there are times in life that life is going to rise up and look you in the face. Something is going to happen in your life that is going to bring you to your knees, a time of desperation. And there may be some of you in here that find yourself in that situation tonight. I can only reiterate for you what Jesus said here. Do not be afraid, only believe. But the belief is not that God would necessarily deliver you, though you could pray for that. Or heal you, though you ought to pray for that as well. Your faith needs to be in the Lord Himself. He may or may not work the way you want Him to work, but I guarantee you, if your faith is in Him, He will never let you down. And one day you will stand back from your situation and look back upon it and realize, you know what? At the time, I thought that He abandoned me, but now I see that He never abandoned me. He never left me. So my question to you is really tonight, where is your hope? Is your hope in God doing something particular for you. You're asking Him to do a work in your life, and you are asking for a particular outcome. Or is your faith totally in Him, trusting that He knows better than I do? And though He might not work it out the way that I would want Him to, I know this: if He does it differently than I would do it, He's going to do it better, not worse. And He's going to glorify Himself, and He's going to love me through it. Because that's who He is. I guarantee you this: the Lord will always say to you, "Do not be afraid, only believe." There will be times He will say, "And you will be made well, and I will deliver you." But not always. But He will always say to you, "Do not be afraid, only believe in me." Let's pray.